Good morning. Welcome to Senate Judiciary Committee. Today is the 26th day of April. It's now about 8:40 a.m. Senator French, Senator Seekins, Senator Huggins, Senator Terrio, Senator Guest, we're all present and ready to roll. Just before we get started, I wanted to take the opportunity to introduce a friend of mine who is here going to be visiting. In the front there is Roger Maynard. Roger is an old family friend for a long time. He's married to my wife's former college roommate in nursing school. And Barb's more like a sister than she was a roommate. So Roger and Barb live in Ketchikan. He's a retired state trooper. And I just want everybody to be careful because he's also very well known in Southeast for his political cartoons. So make sure you keep your hair nice and neat. And Roger, I see he's got his sketch pad there. So just putting all the members on notice that you may be the subject of a political cartoon. Welcome, Roger, and I'll introduce him as well later. Senator Dyson, I'd like to have you come up first, please. We will refer the committee to Senate Bill 20. Any opening remarks, Senator Dyson?
Well, I apologize to the committee for my machinations that have complicated the issue here, and I appreciate your patience. After you all passed the bill out, two of my friends on this committee had amendments that I'm quite sympathetic to, and so I asked the bill to come back here. Senator French and I put quite a bit of time and effort into trying to figure out how we could craft the enhanced penalties for assaulting a woman who was pregnant. And after working at it quite a bit, we decided that it was too tough, and as we had decided a year ago, probably more appropriately done in a separate bill. And so we decided jointly to not try to craft an amendment that would do that in SB 20. Senator Guest has some language that makes it even more clear, I don't know if it's necessary, but even more clear that there won't be, as a result of SB 20 passing, there won't be an action against a woman who has conflict of interests and may choose a path of action that makes more jeopardy for her unborn child. And I'm very sympathetic to what Senator Guest wants to do. I don't know if Senator Guest has that language ready or not. She and I had talked about it being introduced an amendment on the floor, and as I understand the spirit of it, I would not only not object, but would be at least mildly supportive, even though I think it's superfluous. But it does make it clear. So my request to you all is that you get the bill back out of this committee as you had done before, and we get it onto the floor. And I appreciate your tolerance, and once again apologize for the extra work I've given you.
Thank you. Senator Huggins. Or Senator Guest, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, I did. I did have an amendment ready for Saturday because I was told that it was going to be up on Saturday, and I was also told there was an R version, which is what the drafter did the amendment. I haven't been given an R version. I'm not sure.
I have an R version.
So I have an R version.
My apologies. I do not have an R version.
Is that the version that's before us is R, or is it?
R didn't leave this committee, I don't think. Did it?
One that
the final version in the bill packet here is R.
R is the final version as it was amended. Is that correct? We did have some amendments, and R is the final version.
Then I have an amendment to R, and I'm going to trust that the drafter drafted it correctly.
Do you recall where that was, Senator Guest?
Yeah, it's written, and my apologies. I didn't know what the plan was for today.
You're slowing down our progress here, Senator Guest.
I know. It was not my intent. For some reason, in my bill packet, I didn't see version R, so.
While we're doing that.
Senator French?
I have an amendment, Mr. Chairman, that I shared with Senator Dyson last week when we were discussing trying to get our two bills put together, and we eventually decided it was not fruitful to try to do so. Nevertheless, I had one other amendment to go into this bill, and so I'll just pass it around at this point. If you could pass a copy to the other members, Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Are you offering this amendment, Mr. Senator French?
I am.
We'll title it Amendment Number 1, and Senator French has offered the amendment. I object for purposes of explanation.
Mr. Chairman, the amendment reads that the legislative intent, would add a legislative intent section to the bill. It says that nothing in this act is intended to grant personhood status to an unborn child as defined in Section 6 of this act, or to create any other legal basis for a challenge to the U.S. Supreme Court's holding in Roe v. Wade. And the purpose behind the amendment is to address some concerns. Senator Dyson and I have discussed this at length. I don't ascribe these issues to him, but there are concerns in some of my constituents that underneath this bill is a desire to overturn Roe v. Wade, and underneath this bill is a sort of a force that would eventually grant personhood status to a embryo or fetus, and you could use that basis for overturning Roe v. Wade. And Senator Dyson has told me that's not his rationale behind the bill, and I don't have any reason not to believe him. I do believe him. Nevertheless, there's that great concern amongst folks in my district and constituents that I listen to, and so I thought that adding this language would alleviate many of those concerns, and that's the purpose behind the amendment.
I think the content of the law is the content of the law. I don't know how any state law can overturn a U.S. Supreme Court decision. My objection is maintained. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I respect that. I'm not an attorney, and I don't know if the statement you just made is true. It seems like things are appealed, but I think Senator French makes a good point in that I think we have all done a very good job at checking our opinions of Roe v. Wade at the door and crafting what we thought was an appropriate bill towards the sponsor's intent. It has not been expressed by this committee nor by the sponsor that this is the intent. I think there is a fear out there. I think fears are rational. And I think we do a lot for dialogue by passing this amendment.
Further discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Fitch?
Yes.
Senator Huggins?
No.
No.
Yes.
No. So the amendments failed 3-2. So amendment number 2 is before you. Senator Guest, are you moving amendment number 2?
Yes, please.
Senator Guest has moved amendment number 2, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. Senator Guest?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a discussion last time we heard this bill about women in domestic violence situations who may stay in that situation, because as we know, the two most violent times for a woman are leaving or being pregnant, and it's a difficult decision for many women. What this does is, in the two places we were discussing at the last meeting, manifesting extreme indifference of human life, and that it wasn't the intent of this committee nor the sponsor for women who stay in domestic violence situations to be criminalized under that clause. In making, I did have a discussion with Tam Cook. It was her opinion that we should put, if that was the intent of the committee, we should put this language in, that it wasn't superfluous. But in her reading of what manifesting extreme indifference to human life meant, that she thought it was a good thing to put in. And so they have drafted it in this manner to put it right after both of the sections which discuss manifesting an extreme indifference to human life.
Discussion, Senator Dyson, comment?
No, Senator Guess has accurately characterized both the discussions here in this committee and our discussions, and it certainly, this language was my intent, and I don't think it does any damage. I think it makes it clearer, and I have never wanted this bill to result in criminal charges against a pregnant woman who's in difficult situations, only if indeed it's reckless indifference to the life and health of her child. I'm fine with this.
Look, to me, the key words are by itself. There are many different levels of domestic violence. Some of them can be much more life-threatening than others. And so on that basis, I have no objection. I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, amendment number 2 is adopted. Further amendments to the bill?
Chair,
Senator Huggins.
I think it's time we take action on this bill.
Senator Huggins?
Yes. I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 20 be moved with as amended with individual comments and attached physical note.
Is there objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 20 as amended has moved to the next committee referral. Short recess.
Mr. Chairman.
We're back on the record. Thank you very much for your patience, and we'll move now to Senate Bill number 5. Senate CS for CS for House Bill number 95. And this is, we're looking at the / L or Lima version. This is a governor's bill, and we have able staff on hand to present it. If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your presentation this morning.
Senator Seekins, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Monsager. I'm the director of the Division of Public Health, and I'm pleased to present the CS version of House Bill 95, and I beg the indulgence of Senators Huggins and Terrio that have heard what I'm going to share over the next few minutes to introduce the bill in the way I've done at previous committee meeting hearings. This is presumably the last committee of referral for this bill. It's passed through the House and is now getting toward the end of its Senate journey. So it's been amended numerous times as it's gone through its legislative journey to date. We're getting close to the end, I hope. So with that, I just want to spend a few minutes. I think you have some slides in your packet that look, have public health promoting and protecting and promoting the health of all Alaskans, some PowerPoint slides.
Right.
And I'm just going to talk through that just briefly, and we can use that as a reference document, that if there are questions about the bill and some of the amendments that have been made as it's gone through its legislative journey. What I want to do in the next few minutes is just do a very brief introduction about public health, why this bill is important to the state, review some problems, many problems with the current statutes, briefly highlight elements of the proposed bill. We have one last amendment that has been suggested by attorneys in the Department of Law, a clarifying amendment to an action that was taken on the House floor 3 weeks ago that I'll present at the end for your consideration. And then we're available to answer questions. Mr. Dan Branch from the Department of Law has been the attorney that has been working with us in partnership, and he's here too if we have questions, okay? Slide two is a quote from the Institute of Medicine. Public health is what we as a society do collectively to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. This isn't about health care for poor people. This is about health for all people in the state. And when you think about what's happened over our country, the governmental part of the health care of the health public health system over the past 150 years, think about what's happened with cities when sewage systems were installed, safe water, this last century, protection from vaccine preventable diseases after World War II, clean indoor air policies in the last 25 to 30 years, and then mandated removal from the environment of proven causes of cancers and other problems such as taking lead out of gasoline 25, 30 years ago, et cetera. Those are all actions that government has taken at different levels over the last few decades that affect the health of all of us as citizens of our state. Page three is just a quick comment about this, that for us in the Division of Public Health, that we're really focused on the populations of the state, not on the treatment per se of individuals, and we focus more on prevention. That's really what we as a governmental role in the public of health, that our primary work is. So what kind of stuff do we do? We work in partnership with local governments around TB prevention and in putting PPDs on school teachers and bus drivers and school kids. Partnership, you remember the articles in Anchorage last fall about partnering with the Anchorage School District and trying to get data for the community of Anchorage about the incidence of childhood obesity as that community now wrestles with that question. This work we do in the background. Usually you don't hear about us very much if we do our job right. In some respects, though, we also have to be like a fire department, that we have to be prepared for emergencies that happen can happen quite quickly. Just one story from last summer with oysters in Prince William Sound and Kachemak Bay. A cruise ship came in to Whittier, and there were a lot of people with GI disease as they got off. Initially, we thought this was a typical norovirus infection that unfortunately affects cruise ships. But a smart physician's assistant in Whittier picked up on the fact that there are a lot of people who had eaten oysters on the way across Prince William Sound. And the end result of that story was to find out that a species of Vibrio, which causes cholera in its worst form, this was another species of Vibrio, was in oysters that came out of Prince William Sound, and then subsequently we found were in Kachemak Bay. This had never been cultured or grown north of 61 degrees north latitude before any place in the world until last summer. It's a temperature-dependent organism, and with the warm summer we had last summer, the growing conditions were warm enough that we now, but for this summer, we now have to have in place a whole new surveillance system for oyster farms in our state to make sure that oysters are safe to sell, and if there are certain times of the year when it's not, that they're not on the market, or the growers, which they will probably do, they'll sink the oysters deeper in the water as the water warms up. So that's kind of the public health work in the background that affects that industry, just as an example. Page four, just as a quick comment on the core services of the division, the part I'm responsible here in the state, and you can see kind of some of the work we do. Page five, public health emergencies is what we need to be prepared for, whether it's man-made or natural. So in this era, since 911 and anthrax, man-made disasters is clearly something we have had to build up and rev up for in a way that people hadn't thought too much about in the last 4 or 5 years, but also for natural disasters as we've seen this winter with tsunamis in Southeast Asia. That's another part of the public health preparedness mission that we have to be ready for. Laboratory testing capabilities for man-made anthrax, other kinds of toxins, need to be ready to work with communities if public water systems, sewage systems, and so on get compromised. All of that work is preparedness work that's important. One of the stories that's important for us as we go forward has been avian flu out of Southeast Asia. If you've been watching the newspapers or Business Week this winter, you've seen that in Vietnam and Cambodia, this new variety of flu has again been endemic in the bird populations in Vietnam. The death rate is reported, as last I've seen, as of a couple weeks ago, of about a death rate of about 70%. The death numbers are somewhere around 75 people in Vietnam. So far, this disease hasn't mutated to really be human-to-human transmissible. The big concern of epidemiologists all over the world is that it might become so. And if it does, it's going to be a worldwide public health emergency to try and contain it. The good news about SARS from a couple years ago is that we learned that we can contain a viral disease by aggressive isolation and quarantine practices. If you remember what happened in Toronto, they really had to use very rigorous isolation and quarantine authorities to stop that epidemic in Toronto and not spread wider in North America. Avian flu would be similar. We would need to have similar tools in place to be prepared to deal with that. Slide 6 talks about what this bill is about. It was introduced by the governor on both the House and Senate side. This version now, as we're getting toward the end, is the Senate's changes made to the House bill that passed the House. The laboratory facility for diagnosis of virus diseases is in the varying varieties of capital projects that's being considered in the legislature at this moment. Slide 7 and 8 just show some pictures of the past about quarantine and isolation. We remember stories from our childhood, many of us, of polio vaccines in the 50s. I trained in pediatrics at Los Angeles County. The Children's Hospital of Los Angeles County is the old polio hospital from the early 50s there. So for our public health law in Alaska has been broad. It dates from the 40s. And it worked reasonably well. Now as we come into the new century, many problems with it have become much more apparent. If you go to slide 9, the problems, biggest problem, or one of the main problems with it, is that it only has quarantine and isolation authority for tuberculosis and SARS. We would have to have the legislature consider any new disease that might hit the state. When SARS was a worldwide concern in the spring of a couple years ago, the legislature thankfully was in session and quickly amended the law. That's not a good policy for us as a state to have to rely on that kind of an approach to disease. Slide 10 talks about what's in this bill. Most of the present public health laws date from the 40s, and then with amendments in the 90s and in 2003, for two specific disease conditions. Up until the mid-90s, these general authorities from the 40s were interpreted by the courts as general enough and good enough. In the 90s, courts started questioning whether the department had authorities to deal with tuberculosis, which is why the legislature passed a whole series of tuberculosis statutes. And that's the only real change that's been made to those statutes. Slide 11, what's in this law? It's really a statutory framework supporting the public health mission. It gives clear authority and control for conditions of public health importance. And the other thing is it adds in modern due process rights. With our current statutes, if we try to do something with quarantine and isolation for an individual, you're pretty much at the mercy of a judge in whatever jurisdiction you might end up at as to how much due process, how much appeal rights you would be granted. And so that's the other purpose of this law, is to balance the protection of the public good with stating clearly in statute what the due process rights of the individual are if somebody perceives that we have not acted appropriately. I'm not going to say too much about slide 12. This just defines what's in this act. And one of the things that's important for us as public health professionals is defining essential public health services, what's the work we're about, growing out of updating from the Institute of Medicine work nationally in the last decade. Slide 13 just lists what's in the various sections of this act. And then let me go to slide 14. The slide 14 goes into a little more detail then on what's in the act in terms of relating to public health. You can see the intent in Section 1. Part 2 is administration of public health law, and then Part 3 is public health powers and authorities and all of the different subject areas that are in the act. Slide 15, as I said, this is really a balancing act about balancing individual rights versus the common good. There are many constitutional constraints on governmental public health powers. The first important Supreme Court decision was in 1905, 100 years ago, and established, it was a smallpox vaccination case. Somebody objected to smallpox vaccination in Boston, and the Supreme Court laid out really the principles by which government can decide that it needs to constrain individual liberties, and those constitutional constraints 100 years later are now embedded in state law, in court decisions, and have been updated some, but still the fundamental issues in that court decision still are relevant today. Slide 16, some more detail about this. The constitutional permissibility of public health powers really have to satisfy four tests: public health necessity, reasonable means, proportionality, and harm avoidance. And those are really embedded in this law and are embedded in court decisions and public health practice all over the country as how we deal with balancing the individual rights of the individual with the rights of the community. Slide 17 then talks about some of the limitations on governmental public health powers. Some of them were in our initial bill when it was introduced in January, and some have been enhanced and added to as it's gone through its legislative journey. You can see what they're listed there, and we can talk about them if you have questions. But these are limitations that are inherent, that are built into the bill. And this continues on page 18. I would point out on page 18 that number 5 on that list is the only emergency power that the department has in this bill, absent a judge's decision or a judge's involvement. All the other actions that we would take that would constrain, especially in the case of isolation and quarantine, require a judge involved. And the only time in which we could do something on an emergency basis without a judge's involvement is if it's issued by a state medical officer, only when there's probable cause to believe that delay in imposing isolation or quarantine would pose a clear and immediate threat to public health. In other words, ordinarily a judge will be asked for an order. The situation would be something like a plane's coming in from Saigon. It's been reported that avian flu is now transmissible to humans. The pilot reports that several people on board are now coughing, have a low-grade fever, and we need to quickly find out if these people have ordinary flu or do they have avian flu, and we would do an immediate order as the plane lands in order to get testing done, and would know a few hours later whether those individuals need to be isolated until we see how sick they are or whether it's just an ordinary version of the flu. And that would be really a very, very rare circumstance where there would be an immediate risk to the public health.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Monsegur, frequently rules like this or powers like this also come along with a provision that you'd be seeking a court order simultaneously. And is there a provision like that here in the bill?
I ask Mr. Branch if that's okay. Mr. Branch, I can't. Is there inherent in here that we would be seeking a court order at the same time we would impose an immediate, if we use the immediate risk to public health?
You'd put yourself on the record, sir.
And I apologize for being distracted. My name is Dan Branch. I'm with the Department of Law. Yes, there's a provision that we have to apply within a certain amount of time for a court order. So the idea is, and if you give me a moment, I will.
As I recall, it's 48 hours at a maximum before a judge would have to have been involved and have to issue an order whether it's to be allowed to continue. You can look while I continue.
So it's not that there has to be the concurrent action, it's that there has to be a follow-up action.
Correct.
Within a certain time, within a time certain.
Mr. Chairman, that's
yes.
Correct.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I believe it's on page 14 of the bill at subsection E, the isolation quarantine provision, at line 10. Within 24 hours after implementation of the emergency administrative order, the department shall notify the Superior Court by filing a petition under section D, subsection E.
Okay. that answer your question, Senator French?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Manzager.
Then, Mr. Chairman and the committee, to continue on briefly, and I'm just about finished, on page 19, this summarizes the due process provisions that are in the bill, and it also includes the penalties for violations of statutory provisions that are in the bill if we as public health employees don't follow the law.
Okay.
And then the last slide on page 20 is where I hope by the time May 10th comes is that Alaska is no longer in this column all by itself over on the right-hand column. This is a table that was put together by Trust for America's Health that surveyed all of the preparedness laws of all the states in the country, and right now we are the only state in the country that doesn't have general quarantine and provisions authorities, and I'm hopeful by May 10th that Alaska's no longer in that column.
Questions for Dr. Manzager? Go ahead, sir.
The only other thing that I'll offer to you is one last amendment. And this goes to an amendment on page 2 and has been requested to clarify in the penalty provision that was amended on the floor of the House to make it clear when the state could be sued, as I understand it. On page 2, line 21, following the word by, the word negligent would be included. In other words, that the state could be sued for damages caused by negligent medical treatment in this act. And then on line 22, change the word and after employee to or to be consistent with the rest of the sentence. And then on the same line, change the word the to a state employee to make it clear that the state is responsible for the actions of state employees, not an employee of any other organization that might be involved or a nonprofit or something like that. And we've checked with the sponsor of this amendment on the House side, and it's okay with that sponsor if this language were to be included too.
Senator French.
I follow the first negligent, that makes sense, but the second second insertion of or rather than and, if I'm reading it right, I guess I'm not quite sure I get it. It would now read that the action is for damages caused by the imposition or establishment of, et cetera, damages caused by medical treatment provided by a state employee, or except that if the employee or by the state employee, or except that if the employee quarantines or isolates a person with gross negligence.
The or refers back to the except on line 21 or 20. Except for this case or except for that case.
Shouldn't we put like a semicolon in there or something to break that up? It just seems very, seems like a very clumsy sentence.
You could put a...
There's a comma after 395
on
20.
In terms of construction, it could be done either way, a comma or just the or. A semicolon wouldn't be appropriate there.
May I address this issue?
Yes, go right ahead.
Through the chair, Senator French, the purpose of this amendment is to make it clear that there's two separate concepts here, and that's what we're trying to get at. And I, this particular language had been massaged a little bit in state affairs, but we felt like it, just to make absolutely sure so the public would understand what was going on here, although your response suggests that maybe we didn't get there.
How about just a comma at least, something that breaks that sentence up.
I would...
Comma after state employee?
You mean in
on line 22,
well,
state
I mean,
employee.
I think you could...
Comma,
you could,
or accept that.
You could state this, you could say... We're now dealing in the theoretical here because I wasn't an English major. Let's go to line 20. Except colon A for damages caused by medical treatment provided under AS 1855 35 through 395 by a state employee semicolon or that if the employee state isolates a person with gross negligence. Or B.
some way to, I don't know if they want to do I and sub I. I guess they're trying to avoid I and sub or I and, you know, one and two.
You have a chance there to put a.
I'll just go for a comma.
Yeah.
After employee.
So that's word to construction, one way or the other. So we'll amend. We will before introducing the amendment. We'll modify the amendment to show. Page 2, line 22, following state employee, delete and, insert after the word employee, comma, or. That would be how we would look at this amendment. So we've not amended the amendment, we've just modified it before offering the amendment. Does a member wish to offer the amendment?
I'll move it.
Senator French has moved the amendment. And I'll object for discussion purposes. Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The third part of the amendment where we delete the and put it in a state, are we opening up the case that if, for example, a Muni employee quarantines or isolates a person, that they're going to not fall under this section and therefore have an actionable claim? Do we need to worry about Muni employees in this section, I guess?
They don't have authority.
Senator Guest, to the chair, the only isolation of quarantine authority is the state employees.
Okay.
No, and if in the future some home rule or municipality wanted to, other parts of state law would have to be amended before they took that authority.
Thank you. There's
no authority for anyone other than a state employee. Further, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to amendment number one? Seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. Amendment number one to the L version. Further discussion or questions for Dr. Munzacker?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Guess.
Thank you. And I apologize to the doctor and someone online. I had promised to email my questions, and my internet was down last night. So just always throws my day off. On page two, on the state shall pay to a person who is quarantined or isolated a penalty.
Where is this? What line?
I'm sorry. It's the same section we were just discussing, line 22 through 25.
Thank you.
Discusses gross negligence and intentional violations. Is there a reason we didn't include actual damages in here? If someone actually, through gross negligence or intentional violation, quarantined someone and they had actual damages that may surpass the $500 a day, that we're not going to allow them to recoup those damages?
Senator Guest, through the chair, I'll take a first crack at answering questions, see if Mr. Branch wants to add anything. This was debated vigorously on the floor of the House, is trying to exactly your question. And the first thing to remember is the state, an employee of the department, has very limited authorities, as I mentioned earlier. The court's going to be involved from 24 to 48 hours into this in supervising any quarantine and isolation authority. So the time that we could behave with gross negligence or an intentional violations is incredibly limited without court being involved. So after debate, the compromise that was accepted was to come up with a fixed dollar amount to try and answer this question. Initially, there had been conversation in the House about an unlimited tort liability. The administration opposed that. The majority opposed that. And the compromise that was adopted was this compromise.
Go ahead, Senator Guess.
I guess, can you tell me one more time why, and this, I'm guessing this was the debate on the House floor, why it wasn't just actual damages instead of an open. I guess my worry, even though it's a short time period, we deal with a lot of travelers in Alaska. One of them misses a flight or doesn't get back on the boat. That's more than $500 a day to try to get out of Alaska in the summertime. With airplane or whatever, and I just want to make sure that if we do make a mistake under, I mean, pretty high standard, gross negligence or intentional violation, that person can at least recoup the costs that they might incur because of our mistake. So was there a reason why it wasn't just actual, not open up?
Senator Guest, through the chair, I don't remember any actual debate around exactly that question. When it got to trying to work out a compromise, that was the dollar amount that was thrown out, and that was what was accepted. I don't think it was any more scientific than that.
I can anticipate, I can see why we could, it would be very difficult for someone to say, all right, we delayed you because of a public health emergency, and we're only going to be liable up to $500 a day. If the airplane was delayed because of a mechanical malfunction, no one has ever indemnified those people for their actual damages because the airplane didn't operate properly. In that respect, I would hate to say we're now going to hold the state it is a tough question, but I can see why we would limit it to $500 a day. I can see the discussion for that. Senator Guest, did you have another question?
Yes, please. And just on that comment, an airline would at least get you on a flight, and you wouldn't have to pay for that change. And I guess that's what I'm worried about, especially during the summer months.
More than likely, someone delayed by a quarantine would be extended the same courtesy by the airlines. More than likely.
I'll have you have that conversation with Alaska Airlines.
I would bet they would.
Line 19, I just had a question, and this goes to learning about this topic. Number 7.
Where are we now?
Page 5, line 18. And it says, identify, assess, prevent, ameliorate conditions of public health importance through surveillance. Can you just explain the word surveillance to me? I'm unfamiliar in that term within public health.
Senator Guest, through the chair, the way we use this word surveillance in public health is not in the way the law enforcement uses surveillance. Surveillance is used in the context of watching disease incidents or other conditions, mostly through non-identifiable health information, but sometimes through identifiable health information. For example, if we're looking at influenza, we have a surveillance system in place every year in which our laboratory here in Alaska is one of 20-some laboratories in the United States that certain practitioners in the state send in sputum samples when people come in with conditions of flu to be watching for what type of flu is going on in the United States and looking at incidents of flu. Another thing that we do in the surveillance world is looking at causes of death. So we report annually how many people are dying of coronary vascular disease, how many people are dying of this or that, injury data, homicide data, suicide data, in terms of incidence rates and trends over time. What we really, as a profession, work incredibly hard at is protecting people's individual identity. So many communities will ask us for data about what's going on in our community, what do people die of, and will get frustrated with us because we won't report their community-specific data. For example, small villages may think they have a lot of deaths of cancer, and they want us to tell what's their cancer death rate in their small village of 150 people, and get frustrated when we will only report a region data or sometimes even a state data if the situation is rare to protect the identifiable person so that the person's identity doesn't get released. And so there are a lot of standards and data release policies in place to protect so that somebody doesn't get identified that had a diagnosis of A, B, or C.
So this would not give you the power to tap someone's phone?
Correct. Absolutely.
Thank you. It's more like saying you're going to use the powers of observation and data collection to be able to come to some kind of a reasonable conclusion.
And Senator Seekin, the other way to think about it is our job is to provide data to people in your position as policymakers so that you can use to, when, for example, there's debate in the legislature this session about an active seatbelt law, for example. What data do we have to say it makes a difference nationally or in our state? There are other bills that have been under consideration this session around meningitis. What do we know about meningococcal meningitis? We get that data through observation and collecting data, and then we report it in a way to protect individual's identity, but in a way policymakers can use it.
Thank you. Senator Terrio?
Well, you've got the word surveillance there, and you've got then epidemiological tracking. That's the tracking of what type of flu it is. So would there be a problem with limiting surveillance to surveillance of clinical data, or?
I'm looking behind me, Senator Terrio, at my expert, at Ms. Erickson. You want to come up here and answer it? Ms. Erickson is the deputy of the Division of Public Health and has been in this field a whole lot longer than I have and has been involved nationally in developing a model act that states have used to test their statutes against.
My name is Deborah Erickson. I'm a deputy director of the State Division of Public Health. Senator Terrio, through the chair, and Senator Guess, the use of the term surveillance really is a term that's in very common usage in public health practice, and it really is referring to monitoring of health conditions in communities. And I think Dr. Monsager, I think, did a very good job of explaining how that term is used.
I don't have an objection to the term, but does anyone else? Adequate explanation on the record. Other concerns, questions, comments? Senator Guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on something you had just said, Doctor, on data, and I appreciate what you had said, which is, you know, you don't provide summarized data if it's going to identify the people behind that summary. Is that in statute somewhere? Is that in regulation? How do we know, at least, how do those of us in the legislature and the public know that that's actually going to happen and that's what the law is?
Senator Guest, through the chair, it happens both ways. There is, in this law, a section about identifiable acquisition and use of identifiable health information. It starts on page 8, line 26. And so this deals with the only conditions under which we can acquire and use identifiable health information as pertains to this part of the statute, 355 to 395. Then on page 9, starting on page 4, there's information security safeguards about when we disclose, and it has to be in a confidential manner. So in statute, those are there. In regulation, the particulars about what I was just talking about protecting identity and how we group data and so on, are in regulation. And one of the things that will happen after this statute passes is then we have to go back and update all of our regulations. So that'll be the next year's process of putting out for public comment to bring the regulations up to date. Okay. There's one other additional protection for identifiable health information, and that's the federal law called HIPAA. The health information privacy, what's the AA stand for? Anyhow, the very rigid rules for all of us that deal with identifiable health information and protecting the confidentiality of that.
Mr. Chair, and just for the record, identifiable health information is the information that you can track back to a person.
Senator Guest, that's correct.
Other questions for Senator French?
I have a note here that there's some concern about the use of radiation. Does this bill envision the use of radiation in any stage of the quarantine process to treat an infected individual or to decontaminate any of the areas that might be contaminated?
Senator French, through the chair, the answer is no. The reason hazardous materials are included here is there are situations, as happened in Chernobyl. Our state's a very low risk because we don't at this time in history have nuclear energy producing devices, but that you can have, if you have a radiation accident, people can become contaminated. It's usually mostly their clothes, but the people themselves with enough exposure can be a risk to other human beings, and so that's why it's included in here in the unlikely event. In our state, you would have to imagine what most likely happen in an accident at a hospital where radiation is used for treatment of cancers. That's really would be the highest risk probably. And actually in a voluntary manner with certain radiation treatments in our state, people stay in voluntary isolation for 24 hours or so because they acquired enough radiation.
So to the extent that it appears in the bill, it appears as a issue to be contained, not a treatment to be used.
Senator French, absolutely.
Other questions? Senator Guest?
Yes, thank you. Page 6, line 1, just talks about who we collaborate with, and we specifically say including municipalities, Alaska Native organizations, et cetera. We don't specifically say the federal government. We have a large Indian Health Service component in the state. Was there, I know including doesn't exclude anything, but I was just wondering why the federal government wasn't specifically included.
Senator Guest, through the chair, it's amazing. No matter how many hearings we have, we find new things we didn't think about. Because we clearly collaborate with, we gather data from the military system, the healthcare system in our state, from the VA system. So yes, we do collaborate with the federal government.
And it's clearly implied.
I think I would interpret that it's implied in public partners, but we don't specifically state it, and you're correct.
Other questions for Dr. Munzager? Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation of the bill and answering the questions. We have one person in the audience that wishes to testify. Marie Darlin. Marie, welcome back to the Judiciary Committee. If you'll put your name on the record and your association, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to support this bill, which you have a letter, Marie Darlin, representing AARP. You have a letter from our organization supporting this bill, and I don't know that I can add much more other than the comments there that this is a comprehensive update, which most of us recognize has been needed for some time, really, particularly with all the things we're faced with now, and that the department certainly is faced with, and that AARP believes that the state government has this responsibility, and we're glad to see the bill.
Okay. Any questions for Marie? Thank you very much. Marie, do we have anyone online? Anchorage is online. Do we have a list? Oh, here it is. Let's see. We have Anchorage online. Michael McLeod Bull. Mr. McLeod Bull, are you online this morning?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. If you'll put your name on the record and your affiliation, we'll hear your testimony, sir.
Thank you very much. I'm Michael McLeod Bull. I'm the director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. I've spoken on this bill several times before, and have had the pleasure of working with Dr. Munzager, and appreciate his efforts and the efforts of his department to try and bring clarity to this particular issue. The Alaska Civil Liberties Union does not oppose the bill. We do continue to have certain concerns about the expansive authority that is granted to the state under this bill, and I will take just a couple of minutes to highlight the primary concerns we have with the bill. First of all, you've already touched on one of the issues, and that is merely a matter of semantics. I think an excellent issue was raised with the discussion of the term surveillance. I think it would be very easy to put in a simple definition in accordance with what Ms. Erickson said was the use of the term. You could add that to the definition section, and that would remove any question about the scope of that particular authority. The other term, and this is our primary concern with the bill, is that there continues to be no definition of the term significant risk to public health or substantial risk to public health. And I'm not sure if both of those terms are still in there or just one of those terms is in there now. But that phrase, substantial risk to public health, is the phrase that will determine the scope of authority that the government has to act under this legislation. We think that there will be no question in those most severe circumstances when the government has the authority to act. And everybody will agree that when there's smallpox involved or the avian flu or some similar dire set of circumstances, the courts, the the government and the people of the state are going to agree that the government has the authority to act. The question will be on closer calls, when there is an issue that is not quite certain whether the government should have the authority to put somebody in isolation or quarantine against his or her consent. How do you define whether the government has the authority? And the only thing that the court will have to go on is this phrase, whether there is a significant or a substantial risk to public health. And so we're left thinking, what's the best way to help the court decide when that authority exists? There's a great deal of concern these days about activist judiciary, and it seems to me that that situation arises usually when the court does not have precise guidance from the legislature in interpreting the laws that it happens to have in front of it in a particular situation. And in this case, a court will decide whether or not somebody can be quarantined against his or her will by interpreting this phrase, significant risk to public health. We've urged previously that there be some definition added to this phrase, to this bill, and that's one point on which the department and we have not been able to agree. I think they believe, well, I'll let them speak for themselves, but they believe that the phrase is self-explanatory enough that it will sort itself out. Or perhaps there will be some input during the regulatory process to define that phrase. We believe that it would be better for the legislature to give some precise guidance or at least require the court to consider certain factors in deciding whether a significant or a substantial risk to public health exists. And in particular, we've suggested that there be some measure of the means of transmission, the degree of contagion, and the severity of the threat, of the health threat in particular, in making that sort of decision. So that's our primary concern. We also continue to have concerns with the use of the ex parte judicial process. The isolated or quarantined individual will always know that the department is trying to act, whether in regard to testing or in regard to quarantine or isolation. There's no need to keep that person out of the judicial process, and so therefore we continue to urge that the inclusion of ex parte proceedings in the due process aspects of this bill be removed. We've also suggested that the access to identifiable information remains too broad. Adding a definition for surveillance will help that. We think there could be other things done there. And we have also suggested that there be protections added when an individual who is quarantined or isolated against his or her will and through no fault of their own offer protection to those people for loss of housing or loss of job as a consequence. Those remain our concerns. Again, though, I would like to thank Dr. Monsager and his department for doing an excellent job in putting this bill together and seeing it through. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. McLeod-Bull. Questions for Mr. McLeod-Bull? Yes, Senator Terrio.
Thank you. I appreciate your involvement in this bill and your willingness to work with the department. I'm just looking. I should have highlighted this before I came in for the members. On page 13, lines 4 and lines 21. On 4, you have poses no substantial risk. And on 21, you have significant risk of public health. Then, in addition, on page 15, lines 13 and 18, again, you have the two standards. And Dr. Monsager, I'm just trying to remember the debate in Senate State Affairs. I think we did do something to make the usage of those terms consistent throughout the bill. And if I remember correctly, it's a little bit lower threshold when you sweep people into the system because you're not sure whether they've got the disease. But once you've swept them in and you're able to evaluate them, then it's a higher threshold for them to now prove that they're over the disease and no longer contagious. Is that correct? And that's, I think, was the reason that there was the two standards. And I'm just wondering if you can come up and...
For the record, this is Dr. Monsager. Senator Terrio, through the chair, you have it correct. I'm impressed that you've done it twice now and you've got it correct. I think the comment I would make in response in addition to that is that in order to ask that somebody be put into quarantine and isolation, on page 13, the affidavit has to be very specific, and this was improved in its legislative journey in terms of the specificity of the request to the court. The other comment I would make is that when we can think about isolation and quarantine, the bill states that in regulation we will state that if we're considering isolation and quarantine, it can only, the department can only use this method of disease control if it's the least restrictive alternative. In other words, we need to consider every other method of controlling the disease other than isolation and quarantine first. And then if we decide we do need to use isolation and quarantine and make that case to the court, we then also have to do it in the least restrictive means possible, so that ordinarily that'll be somebody will be in their home. And so there are these other two tests that we have to go through when we're even considering it. So yes, we have resisted defining this term significant risk to public health after lots of consideration, because we're usually going into this with concern and anxiety and without definition. If I was God and knew what the diagnosis was, it would be very easy to define. But on the other hand, the bill has lots of specificity in it, that why we have to state why we're concerned, what the risks are, and have to consider every alternative possible before imposing on people's individual liberties with isolation and quarantine.
Questions? Thank you very much. We'll move next to Nathan Johnson in Anchorage. Mr. Johnson, are you there?
Yes, sir.
If you'll identify yourself for your record and your affiliation, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Nathan Johnson. I am division manager at the Municipal Department of Health and Human Services. And I'm here to support HB 95 on behalf of the Municipality of Anchorage and the Department of Health. Updating the state's public health laws is one of the municipality's legislative priorities. Most of Alaska's public health statutes at present are very antiquated and were created to address conditions that existed nearly 50 years ago, as Dr. Montager mentioned earlier. And in this age of global travel and increasing number of drug-resistant infectious diseases, it is imperative that we be prepared, whether it is for a bioterrorism event or the occurrence of a particularly virulent disease such as the pandemic flu. Again, as Dr. Montager mentioned, the avian flu is of great concern right now. And for those who haven't been tracking some of the back pages of the paper, the Marburg virus in Angola is currently, they've got about 225 deaths. This is an Ebola-type virus, which is having about a 93% fatality rate. It's a very harrowing number. The world is facing an imminent crisis in the control of infectious diseases. The overuse of antibiotics has led to the gradual but steady increase in drug resistance. Without question, the problem is a global concern and is creating dilemmas for the treatment of and response to infectious disease worldwide. However, defining the precise public health risk of an emergent disease is a very difficult task, especially when the strain is as yet unknown. And as Dr. Montager mentioned, we're coming in blind oftentimes. One of the ongoing jokes in this industry is, tell me the disease that does not have flu-like symptoms. And because nearly everything presents itself in that way, so it's frightening when confronted with whether it's SARS or anthrax, they present very similarly. And with all the mutations that are occurring worldwide due to the pressure of antibiotics and the global travel and sort of the mixing up of the populace, we often are confronted with something that's entirely new and presents in a different way. So being too stringent in definition might block us from action on a future event. Just 2 weeks ago, the municipality of Anchorage set up its emergency operations center to respond to a bioterrorism infectious disease scenario. And we very quickly came up against issues of emergency powers and quarantine. And it became apparent that current statute is inadequate and doesn't give us guidance, which really hamstrings us at a critical moment in trying to stop an infectious disease and its spread. As I said, the bill is very important to Anchorage, as it clarifies ahead of time the extent
provides explicit due process to protect individual rights. The state and the municipality of Anchorage have worked in tandem and do work in tandem on nearly a daily basis, tracking diseases throughout the state and the country and other public health threats. So passing this legislation, I believe, will serve to improve our relationship and further our ability to work together to protect the health and well-being of the Alaskan public. Thank you for your time.
Questions for Mr. Johnson? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Johnson. Patricia Center. Patricia, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you'll put yourself on the record and your association, we're eager to hear your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Patricia Center, and I'm a registered nurse and chair of the Alaska Nurses Association Legislative Committee. We have been tracking this HB 95 through its process in the legislature, and we are very pleased with most of the changes that have been made. Since you're the last committee of referral, we are now down to the nitpicky side of making proposed changes. Because of the national attention that has been given to the possibility of a bioterrorist attack, the Alaska Nurses Association has encouraged the Department of Health and Social Services to include in the authority to isolate and quarantine not only those individuals exposed to infectious disease, but also those individuals exposed to poisonous or radioactive materials, and that's where Senator French's comment came from. This has been included in this bill on page 16, line 7. However, we're not particularly happy with the exact wording of that particular line. The term hazardous in a lot of fields has a OSHA kind of connotation to it, related to dangling electrical wires or beams that might fall at a construction site. And we would propose changing that term to the one I had referred to earlier as poisonous or radioactive. In relation to that, radioactivity is not really a substance. Radioactivity is kind of an energy quality of an entity. In relation to this, we would propose changing the wording in that section to read, exposed to poisonous or radioactive materials that can cause serious illness or injury by transmission to others, and getting the word
Ms. Center, Ms. Center, Ms. Center, can you tell us what page you're on and what line?
Yes, page 16, line 7.
It must be another version.
You must have a different.
We all have the same version.
So, what section are you talking about?
Subsection M.
16, line 18. Okay. All right, go ahead.
Okay, let's see if I get this. Okay. Yes, it says in the current bill, hazardous materials that can cause serious illness or injury by transmission of the hazardous material. Well, actually, in radioactivity, there isn't a transmission of hazardous materials. There's a transmission of energy. So that's why I was going to propose removing the terms hazardous materials and just say by transmission to others in that particular line. Does that make sense to you? In terms of radioactive things, we mentioned an accident that could occur at a medical facility, but we do have considerable military bases here in the state, and certainly if they don't store radioactive materials, they might be a stopping point for transport of radioactive materials. And UPSs do occur, unfortunately, so we would like the department to have authority to get involved. And in fact, in reading of the statutes, at least my cursory reading of it, I couldn't find any mention of anyone having authority to deal with people that have been exposed to radioactivity. There's a considerable discussion of transport and handling of radioactive materials, not people. And the health department's provision is people. So, in the closing, I agree with everyone that came before us with the spread of new viruses for which we have no cure. Our only ability to contain these things is through quarantine and isolation. And we propose the rapid passing of this bill this session. Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, on the hazardous materials, the example of the radioactive and whether you're transmitting the the energy. But I think what you want to get at, with specifically with regard to the radioactive material, is whether it's on your clothing, whether there's something that truly can be transmitted. If you had been zapped by some radioactive energy, if the particles are not on you, the source of the energy is not on you, you're not going to be contagious. But so.
I meant to bring a physicist in on this. You can become radioactive and then affect others close to you. It's a property, health department, it's a property that you acquire rather than a substance that's transmitted.
I think, thank you. Appreciate it. Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if you checked with the military, they would say hazardous material describes what right. we're discussing.
Thank you very much. Any other questions for Ms. Center? Thank you, Ms. Center, for your testimony. Hazardous material, I think, would include radioactive material and is a broader definition, is what you're saying, Senator Huggins, and I agree, and is not restrictive, but is a little bit more expansive rather than trying to just bring it to the definition of one category of hazardous material. As I'm reading it. Senator French?
I see Dr. Monsager kind of nodding his head as you make those statements. I wonder if we can just maybe get him on the record about that. Does the department think we're missing something here? Does the department feel like we're adequately covered?
Senator French, through the chair, we wrestled with this question after it was raised, and we've tried to write it broad enough to incorporate radioactivity, poisons, but also in the context of narrow enough that we don't want to be going intruding into people's lives if they're not a risk to the public. And so that's why we use the phrase can cause serious illness or injury. For example, if you think about sarin in the subway in Tokyo, that poison that was used in Tokyo, people could transmit it by breathing out. It could be aerosolized. And so that place would be a place where isolation would be useful.
Okay.
I agree it may not be the best sentence, but I think the intent is pretty clear that what we're trying to get at is broad enough to cover unforeseen kinds of things, but they have to still meet these tests about they have to be a risk to public health before we are going to get involved with them. So the OSHA issues about hazardous materials, if it's not a risk to the public, we're not going to be involved in it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else on the line that wanted to testify? See no one. Anyone in the audience in Juneau that wishes to testify? See no one. Public testimony is closed. Discussion? Senator Guest?
I just had two further questions maybe for the doctor or the department.
Go ahead.
Page 13, when it discusses the petition to the courts, can you tell me, I know that your confidentiality clauses cover this section. Is there confidentiality in the court records, given that this is, you know, very specific data about someone's health? Is there something else that will cover the confidentiality of what goes to the courts?
Senator Guest, the chair, I'm looking for help from my Department of Law colleague here quickly.
Okay. Maybe.
Because I think that's a good point about the intent of this is to try and keep confidential to the maximum extent possible of people's health issues.
Through the chair, Senator Guest, I don't believe the bill covers that. But the court system, of course, is used to maintaining confidential files. And I would expect that they would respond by, you know, continuing to have a system that provides for confidential hearings.
Mr. Branch, if you could speak up just a little bit. We've got interference outside.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said I don't believe that the bill directly addresses that issue, but I feel like the court system would respond, provide confidentiality for these files.
Mr. Chair, do we in this bill or somewhere else in law say that when it deals with these types of data that they must do that? to ensure that we are keeping the confidentiality of people's health records?
Well, actually, if you look at page 15 of the bill, on line 4, these are the hearing rights that individuals have, and it provides that an individual can elect to have the hearing open to the public, which means that otherwise it would be closed to the public, and that would maintain, that would provide the confidentiality for the individual if he chooses not to elect that the hearing be open to the public. So that would create a confidential hearing atmosphere for the quarantine isolation hearings.
Mr. Chair,
just Senator Gass.
Thank you. So you would have a closed hearing. Does that mean the record is closed? And is there somewhere in law that there are penalties, just like there is in for the department, if those materials somehow get out of the courts or someone knowingly
I don't think
those?
There's not a provision that I'm aware of, like in the child need of aid cases, where there's a specific statement about what happens if the court records are, confidentiality of court records are breached. There's nothing like that in this bill, and I'm not aware of anything in existing state law.
Senator Guest, through the chair, the other thing I would add is about the rarity of quarantine and isolation procedures. In the last 10 years, our division has sought court quarantine or isolation authority twice in 10 years. We're currently dealing with one right now for the first time in about the last 8 years. I talked to Rod Beattie, who works for Ashna now, and he was the Secretary of Health for Idaho with a population of about 5 times the state of Alaska's population. They dealt with it about every 2 years, so it seems that's a reasonably equitable kind of, just a couple data points about how often this is going to be used. I don't know if that helps or not with the confidentiality, but this whole process is pretty rare.
In that respect, have we had any difficulties or records of confidentiality being a question or a difficulty?
Through the chair, I'm not aware of any problems with that in our past practice, in anybody's memory of the last 10 to 15 years.
Ariel?
So I'm Senator Guest, I'm not sure I heard your whole question. I was reading part of the material here. What are the penalties if the confidentiality is breached in general with regards to confidentiality of medical records? If somebody in your department breached the information about, that a person was quarantined or a group of people, what would be the results?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, if you look on page 9 at section C and D, if we knowingly or intentionally disclose identifiable health information, we as individuals are subject to criminal penalties as listed there. So that's the primary kind of in the law rule about us as individuals. Then, as I said earlier, there's federal penalties if we violate the federal HIPAA statutes and release of identifiable health information, with civil penalties of dollars and potentially being, I think the ultimate penalty is you can be not allowed to bill against any federal payer. That's the ultimate penalty on the civil side.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my question was about the court system, since the courts, since we specifically say about the department, but we don't specifically say about the courts, and the courts will have this information in the petition.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Senator Gassite, on page 16 of the bill, lines 24 through 29, provides a general criminal penalty for anybody who knowingly violates or there's a B misdemeanor penalty for somebody who knowingly violates a provision of the isolation quarantine statute, and then it's a misdemeanor if the violation is intentional. Now, to be honest with you, I don't think you'd get a prosecution of a court system employee under that theory, because it's not clearly set out. I just, to be honest with you, but you could argue that that would be, that the court system person would be covered by that. But I think that the court system is, you know, the court system is so used to maintaining the confidentiality of information involving children's cases and other probate-type cases in involving guardianships, adoptions, that the court system is a pretty safe bet to maintain the confidentiality. They're in the business, in a sense, of maintaining confidentiality of certain records. I offer that as some reassurance that a particular provision is not necessary. I don't think I can't. I've been doing in another stint with the Department of Law. I did child native aid cases for 10 years or so, and I can't think of one time anybody in the court system has ever prosecuted for violating confidentiality of China records. So I think that they have a very strong sense of responsibility, and that provision in Title 47 to protect the confidentiality of China records has not been utilized, as far as I know. And I don't think we'd need to have a similar change here.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator French.
I think Senator Guess has brought up a fascinating point about the bill. I take it that these are not filed like a China case, so they're not filed as a sealed record. And I guess I'm not even sure that they should be. I mean, I think this is a matter of public concern. If you've got folks that are suspected of having contagious disease, you know, I think, you know, I'm not sure we want to establish a secret court for dealing with these. But it's not clear whether, I mean, it sounds like Mr. Branch is saying, well, generally we don't expect a lot of publicity out of these, and generally the court system doesn't go running to the press. But I mean, the question is whether a reporter can walk up to the front counter at the courthouse and say, I want to see file, you know, this file. And if it's a China case, the court system is going to say, no, can't, they're closed. And if it's a quarantine petition, I'm taking it the answer is yes, because there's nothing that says here that they're confidential or sealed.
The chair, may I respond?
Yes, please.
Senator French, as I explained to Senator Gass, since the respondent to one of these quarantine or isolation petitions has the right to elect that they be open, that infers that they would otherwise be closed, and so therefore you would not be able to, you know, a reporter couldn't go and look at the new filings to see if there was an isolation quarantine petition filed recently.
That's all based on that one line that says that you can elect to have the hearing open.
Well, there's no other way to allow a person to have that election if it's not preserved for him in the future, but you're right. It's not spelled out clearly in the bill, but I think there is, that would be the only logical conclusion you could reach. Otherwise, the election would be meaningless.
I agree with you. That's true with respect to the hearing, but I think if you want to make these files sealed and confidential, there you just rob a sentence out of the China statutes and put it in up front, so you're blunt about it. But I guess I'm kind of still wrestling with the basic policy question, is whether they ought to be open or closed. I'm a little bit hesitant to establish a secret court for dealing with something that's a matter of great public concern.
Senator. Well, if I might interject on that, you know, and we do have to be careful, and just to reinforce what Senator French said, you know, we envision a catastrophic occurrence, a contamination, nuclear contamination based on a dirty bomb, and suddenly we have all these protective mechanisms that makes us dysfunctional when we're trying to protect the public, understanding that we do not want to violate confidentiality of individuals and peoples, but to what end, if it's, in this case, protecting the fact that you were contaminated by nuclear or a contaminated substance.
Senator French, through the chair, the other thing I was just leaning over and talking to Ms. Erickson about is the Model Act that was developed out of a national consultation of looking at state statutes across the country doesn't include a secrecy provision in it as a consideration for states to consider, I think, for exactly the reasons that Senator French talked about, that yes, confidentiality is important, but the public process is also important. The other comment I would make is one of the things the ACLU and we have disagreed about is the ex parte process in getting an order. And our argument has been the reason for ex parte process in the bill is to allow expediency in our geographic state if we need an order on a Friday afternoon, with the understanding that the bill then still requires a hearing if somebody wants it to follow on in a expeditious manner. And I think it goes to Senator Huggins' comment. We want a process that can work, that has reasonable protections, but yet can still work in an emergency than when we need it to.
Yes, Senator, yes.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. And I guess just to clarify, the record, which may be open, I think we've established that I'm not sure even saying that it's going to be a closed hearing, I'll trust you all that that means that the record's going to be closed. But I think, as we've said, there's good public policy reasons. Is the only the information that's on page 13 would be that that's open, or is the intent or the result of this bill that someone's entire health record may be open? And there's the risk to the public, which we're debating whether or not that should be public. Then there's the rest of the person's health information. And is that any, would that be part of these hearings, and would that be open or closed if it doesn't have to do with the public health? But I mean, of course, the situation that I'm thinking about in my head is that, you know, someone has AIDS and they've decided that that's a confidential personal information about themselves that they're not telling other people. They might be fall under the statute that might be public, that they were potentially quarantined. Would their health status of being HIV positive therefore be in the public?
Senator Guest, through the chair, if I think about this, I also would think about that example and an example you might extend it to say it's an HIV positive person who has tuberculosis that's now not complying with medication treatment and has multiply drug resistant, and we need to get this person to take meds both to protect themselves and mostly to protect the public, which is why we're in this bill. If you look at the affidavit, the suspected contagious disease is tuberculosis, not HIV. And because of HIPAA and federal concerns and all of the standards in our business, we would only be putting in this affidavit the absolute necessary things that pertain to this condition, not other people, their background, cancer, reasons that they might have an immunity problem, why they can't handle the condition or something. That's not the public's business to know. It's only what's the contagious disease that they have.
Mr. Just, and that's page 13. That list. I appreciate the clarification, and therefore this information. Okay. One other on a different topic. Question I had: page 12, line 13, and this goes back to the conversation that this committee had on China cases. It says that the department may isolate or quarantine an individual. Is there a reason, given the importance of this decision, that it's not the commissioner or the commissioner's designee?
Senator Guest, through the chair, last 50 years of experience with our department has been that we have done acceptably with it being the department and then putting in regulation who the specific individuals. The statute states here that the only people that can request an order are a state medical officer. And the reason the law is proposed to state that way is to try and remove it from a political appointee, for example, that might have an agenda and be requesting it, that it's only a physician employed by the department that has the authority to request an order from a judge. And so that's the reason it's worded the way it is.
With regards to the confidentiality here, this on page 9, does that language only apply to individuals within the department? Mm-hmm. The confidentiality, or what if there is this argument, you know, we live in an open society, what information is available? So the first question is, that only applies to people in the department, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, yes. The reason why is because it says in subsection C, a person who knowingly discloses identifiable health information in violation of this section is guilty of. So the penalty phase would refer back to A there, which calls about the department.
And I guess, you know, this is, you don't want to have panic in the streets just because somebody, you know, there's general misunderstanding about the disease, how the disease spreads, and things of that nature. And you want the decisions to be based on science.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, can I tell a story?
Sure.
The HIV data that our department has and has collected since the early 90s, because of concerns about inappropriate release and identifying people, has been kept, and our tradition in the department, our practice is it's on a separate computer, it's not connected to the internet, it only two or three people have access to the data files, and because of conditions, certain conditions have such stigmatizing potential in our society that whenever any disease comes along that has that potential, even more safeguards get put in place in practice. And the other reason for doing that within the division is that for the most part, we collect data on a voluntary means, and if we ever breach in practice the release in a way that can be somebody could then be identified, our whole relationship with all of our partners who supply us data and information falls apart if they can't trust that we're going to handle the information in a confidential manner. And so that practice that's not in regulation really is another constraint on our use, because we depend on all of these partners in a voluntary way to work with us.
Okay, and then on page 16, lines 24 and 25, a person who knowingly violates this regulation is guilty of Class B. Again, that applies to department personnel, that's the whole section, or is that broader?
Well, it's
the court section.
I'm sorry?
No.
It's page 16?
It's the entire isolation and quarantine.
Yeah, right. It applies to this isolation and quarantines section. So.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, is my understanding the intent of the sponsor of these provisions wished to have it direct to the department. They were concerned about the department not following through and providing the protections that the bill provides to those who are facing a quarantine or isolation petition. So it wasn't intended to include others. May I just point out that a little higher up on that page in line 11, there's a subsection L requires the department to adopt regulations to protect as much as possible the privacy rights of individuals subject to isolation or quarantine under this provision. So that would mean that someone in the department who violated one of those regulations would be liable. The regulations protecting the privacy rights of the respondent would be liable under those provisions.
Mr. Vice Chair,
yes.
Just to clarify, outside of the department, correct? Or not? I was trying to understand what you
right.
were saying.
I think that was, again, directed towards department personnel as opposed to people outside of the department. But
Senator Guest and Senator Terrio, I think my other comment would be that in general, if I understand the questions, sections N and O really do apply to the department as I understand this section, and it applies to, since if you think about how this all works, it's only the state medical officer who can request
isolation quarantine, a judge is involved. The people that would violate this information would be either the court system, as you pointed out, or us in the department. And I think we're on, I'd have to say I'm unclear whether one could make a case if the court system violated, whether this pertains to the court, but it clearly applies to all of us in the department. And who, nobody else should know about this. If a person chooses to have a closed hearing and doesn't choose to share in an open way, those really should be the only parties other than the individual and their attorney to this information.
So, Mr. Chair?
Senator Guess.
So, at no time is the department collaborating with local municipalities, village police officers, any of the other folks in kind of carrying out the isolation and quarantine?
Senator Guess, you're correct. I thank you for clarifying that. We would, and again, if I think about our current example of a person in the state we're working with right now, the person is getting treated by a nonprofit health organization, and it's out of that person's noncompliance with medication treatment supervised by them that we've gotten involved as a partner. So yes, but then the HIPAA laws also apply in all of those situations that, so all of those partners, we're dealing with identifiable health information, and the federal law pertains to everybody else, too.
I can't imagine, Doctor, that the court would cavalierly release what they know is confidential information. They're super careful about that. It would seem to me just... They when they have closed hearings on other things, they don't let that information out. Just seems to me that would be almost unimaginable. But Senator Guess.
Sure. And not being an expert in HIPAA, does HIPAA oversee or have stipulate on quarantine and isolation status? Would that be part of what falls under HIPAA?
Senator Guess, I don't know. I haven't read the whole statute for a long time. I don't know that it particularly discusses quarantine or isolation, but it generally talks to any condition in which one's using identifiable health information, and it just specifies the conditions in which it can be used. I'll have to, if you want the answer to that, I'll have to go check. I can't answer that specifically.
Senator French?
I think I'm still stuck on a point we passed 10 minutes ago, but I'm kicking it around, and I just want to... talk to the folks here while I've got them. I just see a real tension between the definition, the crime of knowingly disclosing identifiable health information on page 9, and the petition that's filed on page 13, and the definition of identifiable health information. The petition basically has identifiable health information in it. And you know, behind all these, behind all this desire for confidentiality, I can understand why we're not trying to focus any specific attention on this given individual, but I think the public has some right to know that the state is taking action against someone to quarantine them because of something that the public would consider to be a grave matter. And so I guess I'm trying to figure out how we can protect the individual from undue scrutiny and still let the public know that the state is taking this action, is in court, seeking to quarantine someone. And it strikes me you can do that by simply saying the petition is secret or confidential and say so, and still allow for the release of enough information so that the public knows what's going on. I just don't want a secret court regarding public health matters, and yet at the same time I don't think the individual should be subjected to the scrutiny and the, you know, pain, if you will, of the public, you know, sort of pointing at him and her and saying you've been quarantined. So I guess I'm just seeking for a way to release some of the information, but not the identity of the individual. Or
I don't see that conflict. You're talking about confidential information. It's not confidential information under the law that the way I read it, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the public health department says we have quarantined an individual or that there is an investigation. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman, I think that you're right. I believe that there's a an effort in the bill to distinguish between identifiable health information which means information will let the public figure out who you're talking about, and information in general terms about whether the department's taking action to quarantine an individual, a person. So that's not
the public health department could say, we had a plane fly in here from China. It landed. We've quarantined all the individuals on board at this particular time. That's it.
Senator Seekins, as I think about it and think about the traditional use of quarantine and isolation, which was clearly used more often before we had vaccines and antibiotics, but the era now may be coming back, given enough cases, it can't be secret because the concern in the public will be such, and employers won't want people at work if they are a risk to transmitting disease and so on. So at some level, the issue of individual confidentiality loses out, I think, to the public good. And the question we're wrestling with is the balance point in that continuum of circumstances. In the case of one person at a time, of only one person and being able to contain it and so on, we would go to the maximum extent possible to protect the person's at least the conditions under which their health information, as Senator Guest has pointed out. In the hospital industry, I was a hospital director for a bunch of years, the traditional kind of balance point is releasing the name and somebody was admitted, but not what the condition was or what the particular diagnoses are. And that's the balance point around confidentiality. The hospital industry and the press has worked out as a kind of middle of the road. I suspect that that's kind of the middle of the road here, too.
It seems to me that we're holding confidential, identifiable health information here. We're not holding confidential the fact that we quarantined someone with the avian flu. And that's how I read the bill.
And I think that's generally what I'm getting at. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's generally what I'm getting at, but it's not clear where sort of that responsibility lies. And I guess I'm trying to see, maybe I'm missing something, but is the department under any obligation to tell the public when it seeks one of these petitions?
I don't see that it's in this bill. It's not under the obligation to do that. There's no reporting requirement here. But I would doubt that if Dr. Munzauger had a confirmed case of avian flu in the state of Alaska that he would not put out some kind of a public health notice.
Through the chair, we just did a bioterrorism exercise too as a division just a week or so ago about the possible release of anthrax on a cruise ship coming up from Southeast Alaska. And if you remember, the bill says isolation and quarantine are the we use last. So you try and use all the other means first. So we would be doing public health notices to the community about, please don't go to church today if it's a Sunday morning. Please don't have school. Stay at home. Cover your mouth. Don't cough. Wash your hands. All the common things would be going first. And then if we still have to use isolation and quarantine, then there would be more public notices that were going to that step. So it's a stepwise progression that would go on in the community.
Appropriate public notice is already part of your responsibility, is it not?
Correct.
So this doesn't toll any of that, and it doesn't create any new responsibility. It already exists.
But it clarifies what our powers and authorities are to use this tool if and when it's necessary.
But it does say once you become within the group of people who know individual identifiable health information, you must hold it confidential.
Correct. Now, the reality, Senator Seekins, would be if we were in a small Alaskan community and we now had avian flu in that town, we've done several public notices and we've now moved to isolation and quarantine, the public will quickly draw conclusions as to what the concern is, and we'll be making comments. We now are using this tool and so on to try and protect the public.
I'm old enough to remember quarantine notices on front doors of people's homes. So, and my family were victims of polio, so I can remember those days. Senator Guest.
Mr. Chair, and either to you or to the folks testifying, goes back to something Senator French had said, and I just wanted to clarify. If someone submits a petition that's discussed on page 13, petition that we've discussed, how are they not in violation of the provisions on page 9? Because someone's actually knowingly disclosing identifiable health information for the correct reasons, but I'm a little worried on the other end that some poor department person is doing their job, which is filling out a petition, yet they're disclosing identifiable health information, which now we're saying is a Class B, and we don't exempt this type of information.
In the petition, Senator Gass?
In the petition. The petition is identifiable health information, and it needs to be from everything that I'm hearing. But it seems as if we shouldn't be holding department folks accountable for doing disclosing this information in a petition.
Let me ask a question here, because I know that there are other hearings that come before the court where there are petitions for hearing which do not identify particularly the public portions of those petitions, do not particularly identify the individual. Am I correct?
Senator Guest, through the chair, first off, the person has to elect to have this be open. So I would construe that when we're doing our job and making a request and an affidavit to the court, that is still closed. But the other part is on page 8, that the reason we acquire health information is because it relates to a public health purpose, we think that this affidavit is going to contribute to the achievement of a public health purpose, and we can't do it with non-identifiable health information. So is there a
petition under the name of John Doe and ask the court to hear the petition based on a John Doe, just like you would on a minor in some cases. It would be minor child under care or whatever. I don't remember the exactly, but I've seen petitions to court that have been vague enough in their content to not know who the individual was. Is that your experience, Mr. Branch? Have you seen that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, when the Supreme Court issues an opinion in a child need of aid appeal, they'll use the initials or they'll use a pseudonym name. I wonder if I could add a little something to Dr. Monsager's response to Senator Guest. Her concern is that a state employee would get in trouble for sharing information the court would need about the individual in the petition. I think that's covered on page 8, line 26, where the department is allowed to acquire and use identifiable health information if it directly relates to a public health purpose. And a public health purpose would be served by filing a petition for quarantine isolation. So that gives proposed 1815.362 is designed to prevent the department from gathering and using this information unnecessarily, but in a case like this where it serves a valid purpose, they can. So that would resolve your concern, I think.
And certainly a court employee is a state employee.
That's right. Yeah.
A judge is a state employee. So knowing that this is a confidential matter, they would more than likely err on the side of confidentiality to protect the individual.
That's been my experience, Mr. Chairman.
And it is a balancing point here, that because you certainly don't want people shouting from the rooftops that Senator Terrio has the measles and it's a new strain and highly virulent, but you want to keep him confined and you want to be able to do that in a legal manner. I don't have a great concern over the way that it's constructed, but maybe I'm wrong. Other questions? Seeing none, we have closed public testimony. Are there any more amendments by the members? Seeing no further amendments, is there discussion on the bill by the members? Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for House Bill 95 be moved as amended with individual comments and attached fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing none. Senate CS for House Bill number 95 is moved on to the next committee of referral. Thank you very much. Short recess. We just want to take a couple more minutes. Record. Let's take a quick look at Senate Bill 12, which we have before us. And the members have had a chance to review Senate Bill 12. We don't have anybody signed up to do public testimony on Senate Bill 12. Are the members satisfied with the bill at this particular time? Is there a motion?
Yes.
Senator Huggins.
Chair, I move that committee substitute for Senate Bill 12 be moved out with individual comments. And I don't know, was a fiscal note or not?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing none, Senate Bill 12 has moved on to the next committee of referral. Let's take a quick look at calendar. We're going to carry over House Bill 81 till tomorrow. We have tentatively scheduled ethics bills that we would look at for tomorrow. We will, I'm not sure the state affairs will have them out, but if they are, it has to go through at least one session of the floor prior to us hearing the bill. So we're going to start with 81 tomorrow, and we will tentatively recess till 5 o'clock tomorrow to begin that process. We have then Thursday we have 106, 149, 149, and Friday we have an open day. We'll see where we are with the ethics bills and any proposed amendments that we might have to those bills. And we'll work on those bills on Friday, and if we need additional time on that, we'll schedule a session for Saturday. We're on the 24-hour rule at the moment, and that gives everyone a pretty good idea of how we are going to try to move our calendar over the next 3 or 4 days here. Any other items that need to come before the committee?
So, Mr. Chair, 5 p.m. on Wednesday is an additional.
We're tentatively scheduled for 5 p.m. as a recess from the morning session.
Wednesday. Okay, thank you.
And that'll be in this room. Is there any more questions, anything else to come before the committee? It's now 10:38, and we're adjourned.